The Sefer Avudram. Sefer Avudram is a sefer from the Middle Ages that deals with minhagim, essentially with the custom of Ashkenaz, and it becomes a primary source for those later poskim who deal with Ashkenazi custom. And in his sefer, he deals with the davenings of Rosh Hashanah, among other things, and he quotes Rav Sadia Gaon. So let's just say a word about Rabbi Sadia Gaon. When we talk about the period of the Geonim, from about the 6th century and something till the 10th century, but essentially till the 12th century, we talk about the period of the Geonim, it doesn't mean it was 600 years of geniuses. Today we use the word Gaon to be somebody who's like a luminary. You might refer to him as a luminary in Torah, a Gaon. And indeed, it comes from a pasuk in Yeshayahu, Gaon Yaakov, which means the bright one from Yaakov. And it's interesting also why the title Gaon Yaakov was used. Because who was it applied to? It was applied to the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva in Bavel. And Bavel, in those days, ended up in Baghdad. So the Yeshiva was in Baghdad. There was at one time, before Baghdad enters the picture, there was Sura and Pumbedita and Nahar Da'ah. There were different cities, Mechoza, that had yeshivot. And we are familiar with the great Amoraim of the Talmud Bavli, their names, who they are. We know who they are and what yeshiva they came from. But when you end up with the days of the Gemara, the days of Ravina, Rav Ashi, and then we move on, so the moving on becomes dark ages, if not for a particular Rosh Yeshiva in Baghdad, who was asked a very simple question: how is the Mishnah written? How is the Gemara written? Very simple question. And those two simple questions generated a book called Igeret Rabbi Shrira Gaon, Shin Reish Yud Reish Aleph, Shrira. Now, we know his son, who's more famous, and it's Ha-Hei Aleph Yud, Hai. It doesn't mean he said hi to everybody, right? Rabbeinu Hai Gaon, very famous of the Gaonim, one of the outstanding ones of the Gaonim. So his father is Rav Shrira Gaon, who writes this letter, but it wasn't just a letter. Today you buy it in hardcover. It's a book, Igeret Rav Shrira Gaon, and he provides details of time and place and names of what went on from the days of the Mishnah until his own day, which is the tail end of the period of the Geonim, and it incorporates those 500 dark age missing years. Who are they? When are they? And all of a sudden we find out that there were great people who headed the yeshivot here and there, and when, what their tenure was, and so on. So it's very, very important. So the reason they called the Rosh Yeshiva in Baghdad, which was really the Suri Yeshiva and Pupadit Yeshiva merged together, was because he was the head. Today you call him the Rosh Yeshiva. And then they called him the Gaon Yaakov. The Ramban one says that Yaakov is Am Yisrael in the diaspora, and Yisrael is Am Yisrael in a redemptive stage. So here they were in Galut, in Bavel, so in Baghdad. So he was the Gaon Yaakov. Now, as it turns out, not every one of the Rosh Yeshiva was, in our terms, a real Gaon. He was the administrator, the top administrator, the CEO, or the president of the yeshiva, where he had a large measure of fundraising capacity. Now, things haven't changed. Some things haven't changed. Where many a Rosh Yeshiva spends most of his time raising money for his yeshiva. Now, you might think, did Rav Moshe Feinstein raise money for his yeshiva? He did. He did, but he didn't spend most of his time. He had people in the office who would set things up, and all he would have to do is show up and make a speech and so on, but he wasn't the one who really did the pitch. The other people did it for him, but he was the figurehead, and no doubt. But there were some Rosh Yeshiva who were rather active in being the fundraisers. And when you're a fundraiser on a full-time basis, it comes at a price of your own learning, your own teaching, and in all likelihood, there could be people in the Beit Midrash who are subordinates in the hierarchy of the yeshiva, but are much greater Talmidei Chachamim than you are, even though you're the Rosh Yeshiva. So you're the Rosh Yeshiva, or you might be the Gaon, but the big names are people under them. So therefore, every time you see they're quoting one of the Gaonim, you always have to know who we're talking about. Because some are high ranking in the hierarchy of Gedolei Yisrael for generations, and some are less known, let's just say, for a better word, less known or less accepted, and so on. So from the big names of the period of the Gaonim, Rav Sadia Gaon stands out. He was literally one of the greatest, both in terms of Rav Sadia as a halachist, but more so as a Baal Machshava, philosopher. He writes the book Emunot V'Deyot. He also writes the book Sefer Mitzvot. He also composed many, many poems, and he was an absolute luminary. The fact that the Rambam later on, a few hundred years later, challenges Rav Sadia does not take away an iota from the greatness of Rav Sadia. On the contrary, the Rambam writes with great admiration about Rav Sadia Gaon, yet he feels that here and there, you know, he has the right to challenge him, which is fine, because the Rambam believed he can challenge all of the Gaonim. The Rambam believed that he was locked into the days of the Mishnah and the Gemara. But once the days of the Mishnah and Gemara are behind us, it's an open field. And the Rambam felt, if I agree, I agree. If I don't agree, I don't agree. And it's just okay. And then you have, as I mentioned, Rav Hai Gaon. There was a Rav Yehudai Gaon. So you have some very, very famous of the Gaonim. But most of the names we don't know. Most of the names are anonymous. And as a matter of fact, somebody once pointed out that the name of Moshe, they said since the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, nobody used the name Moshe until the Rambam. It's not true. It's not, what? Yeah, but it's not true also. Because in the Igeret Rav Shura Gaon, there's a Rav Moshe Gaon. There's a Rav Moshe Gaon. So you had a name. And maybe it was used in the days of the Amoraim, except there was no Amora worthy of bringing him into the picture. So I don't like these drushas that, you should be careful when you say never, because somebody inevitably is going to show you up that it's not true. And then when your authority becomes undermined here, and it becomes undermined elsewhere too, and people, you know, subject. So here Rav Sadia Gaon comes up with 10 different reasons why we blow shofar. Now, as we'll see, all of the 10 cannot be from Sinai because they refer to events way after the giving of the Torah. So the Torah was given, and we're told in Parshat Pinchas, Yom Truah Yelechem, it should be a day of hearing the sound of the Truah. And when we say the Truah, we're not talking about the particular sound that we call Truah. Truah in the Tanakh means a sound of crisis. That's what it means. A sound that will jolt people into action, as opposed to a straight sound is always defined as a sound of simcha, of joy, of roga, of calming down, a calming sensation. It's a very straight sound. And you have in the Torah itself the usage of tkiah as opposed to truah in two psukim in Parshat Balotcha with regard to trumpets, but it's the same idea. It says, "Uviyom simchatchem v'moadechem brashei chodshechem utkatem b'chatzotzot." So on Yom Tov and Rosh Chodesh and so on, and days of simcha, you blow. It doesn't mean blow in terms of the verb blow. It means sound out a tkiah. Utkatem b'chatzotzot. Sound out a sound that will reflect the joy of simcha, which we know halakhically is the straight sound. And then it says, Kitabol milchama ba'artzachem, or hatzar hatzareretchem, if there's going to be a war or other type of calamity, vahareyotem b'chatzotzot. Using the trumpets, you should sound out the cry or the wail of crisis. And the problem was that while the straight sound, there's uniformity as to what the sound is, the tekiah, there is no uniformity as to what the truer sound is. And the Gemara kicks it around and suggests that it might be what we call a shvarim, doo, 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 gasping, or what we call a trua, doo, 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 doo. You know, we call it trua. So the Gemara says, to be on the safe side, we'll do this, we'll do that, and we'll do both together. We'll do both together. And not only that, but the both together comes in two packages, in two flavors. One is when the Baal Tokea is being fed by the Makri, we always have somebody calling out. Does he say Shvarim Teruah in one breath, which then the Baal Tokea is supposed to blow it in one breath? Or does the Makri say Shvarim through and the Baltokea is supposed to go do 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 do. So if the fact is we don't have an absolute decision on it. So because the custom is to blow 100 sounds on Rosh Hashanah, we can play it any way we want, in a sense. So there are different customs. Which set of the tkiot you do it this way, which set you do it that way. Some communities have different minhagim, some shuls have certain different minhagim. But the idea is, let's get them all in, just to be on the safe side. So we end up hearing all variations of what the trua is. And that's what the Torah says. Yom tua yelechem, it should be a day of trua. But there is an independent oral tradition, halacha l'Moshe m'Sinai, that before and after every type of trua, the trua should be sandwiched between two tkiot. So you have a tkia, and then you have something, and then you have a tkia. The something comes in different forms. It could be shvarim trua, it could be shvarim trua, it could be shvarim, it could be trua, whatever it is. But there's always going to be a tkia before and a tkia after. That's in a tradition, an oral tradition from Sinai. Fine. So then we create the scenario of how many sounds that we have, because the Torah uses the word trua actually three times, twice in connection with Rosh Hashanah, and that's in Parshat Pinchas, Yom Trua Yelachem, and once in Parshat Emor, Zichron Trua Mikra Kodesh. And the third usage of the word trua, it has to do with Yovel. It's a follow-up of Shemitah, once every 50 years, except that we don't have it today. We don't have the Yovel year built into the calendar. And that's a shear in itself, why we don't have it. But one of the reasons that we blow shofar at the end of Yom Kippur is to remind us that there actually is a mitzvah of blowing shofar, not after Yom Kippur, but on Yom Kippur once in 50 years. So once in 50 years on the Yovel year, there was the Tkiat Shofar that was identical to the Tkiat Shofar of Rosh Hashanah. So you have the word trua once, twice, and three times. Twice with regard to Rosh Hashanah, once with regard to Yom Kippur. And somebody's going to tell me, right, that 2 days Rosh Hashanah and 1 day Yom Kippur. Except that's not a good answer because there's only 1 day Rosh Hashanah. We observe it for 2 days. But it's a one in the Torah, it's only 1 day. It's the first of Tishrei. And so I always tell the story of when I was visiting in the States many years ago. My parents still lived in the Flatbush. And I went to a shoe store on Avenue J, those who know the turf. And in January, in the middle of the winter, and I overhear one guy ask another one, when does Rosh Hashanah fall out this year? So I pipe up on the first of Tishrei. And he says, thank you very much. Yeah. It's always on the first of Tishrei. I know what he was asking. He was asking the famous Jackie Mason Oliver Sholem line, Rosh Hashanah never came out on time. 1 year it's early, 1 year it's late. You know, Rosh Hashanah never came out on time. But it's always the first of Tishrei, right? So you have the first of Tishrei is Rosh Hashanah. The second of Tishrei, we observe it as Rosh Hashanah, and then you have Yom Kippur. So we have three times the word trua, which means you have to hear the trua three times. And you have to have a tkiah before and tkiah after each trua. So three times three is nine. So all you have to hear is nine sounds. But there's a problem. We don't know what the trua is. So we're going to do each nine different variations, except that one of the variations is not one, it's Shvarim Teruah together. And there's another variation, it's Shvarim Teruah with a breath in between. So that becomes 12. So it adds up and multiplies, and it grows to 30 sounds, at least 30 sounds. That if somebody's at home and cannot listen to Shofar, and somebody comes over to blow Shofar for you, or you do it yourself, you have to hear the 30 sounds. That's the basic, and that's in the Maxer before Musaf. The Tkiot during Musaf is something else. The tkiot during Musaf are the tkiot that the Am Yisrael is blowing shofar. That's not the private person blowing shofar. Am Yisrael is blowing shofar. I can tell you this is one of the last things I ever learned from the Rav, Zichron Levracha. It was in 1985, rather late in his life, where his health, both physical and mental, were failing. Nevertheless, he was able to give two shurim in Boston to a group of Rabbanim who came up to hear him. And he spoke about shofar, among other things. And he said that the Rambam talks about the mitzvah of shofar twice, once in the context of doing a mitzvah, like in the language of any other mitzvah, mitzvat aseh l'shmo kol shofar b'Rosh Hashanah she'ne'emar, it is a positive commandment to fulfill the mitzvah. That's the way he would begin any other mitzvah, which is binding on the individual. But then later on in the halachot, he says, hatzibur chayav l'shmo shofar, the congregation, the tzibur. So you don't have that. The tzibur has to wear tefillin. The tzibur has to eat matzah. It's no such animal. You know, we all eat it individually. And if everybody in the Jewish nation would eat matzah on Seder night, wonderful. But it's not that Am Yisrael ate matzah. But Am Yisrael has to hear the shofar. And that can only be done in the forum of a defined forum of tzibur. And that's a minyan. So in the context of a minyan, we have the shofar blowing as well. Everybody does it in the Chazarat HaShatz. Some shuls do it even in the silent Shmon Esrei. So that's a minhag thing. But the main halakha is to do it in the repetition, in the Chazarat HaShatz. So now let's see what Rav Sadia Goin has to say about shofar. Katav Rabbi Sadia, Mashet Sivanu HaBorei Yitbarach, what God commanded us to blow, Litkoa B'Shofar B'Rosh Hashanah, Yesh Bazeh Asara Inyanim, there are 10 issues that have to be taken into account. And what's fascinating is that he says that they're all the 10 reasons emanate from the mitzvah that was given by God at Sinai. Whereas we're going to see that some of them are historically linked. Does that mean HaKadosh Baruch Hu at Har Sinai anticipated there's going to be a destruction of Beit HaMikdash, and that's one of the reasons? Well, it could be. So let's see how he handles it. So Ha'inyan HaRishon, the first one. Mipnei shehayom haita tchilat habriya shebo bo nibara kadosh b'chol ha'olam. God created the world, umalach alav, and reigned over it. V'chein osim amlachim b'tchilat malchutam shetokim lefnehem b'chatzotzrot u'bekranot lodia u'lashmia b'chol makom hatchalat malchutam. It's a known thing at the coronation of a king that the masses become aware that the reign of the king has begun by sounding out trumpet horns and other horns. And it's something that's done. And here HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted that we should annually remember that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. If you are a Kabbalist, you would not say created the world, but is creating the world. And there's some basis for it. We say it in the davening every day. HaMechadesh b'tuvo b'chol yom tamid ma'aseh bereshit. God is renewing the creation daily. Now, if you study Einstein, and Einstein understood that the expansion of the universe is constant, which means that the universe is larger today than it was 100 years ago. It's constantly expanding. And they're constantly discovering new galaxies out there, which means the process of Briat Olam really hasn't come to a total halt. It may have come to a halt with regard to the created world of planet Earth, but not for other places. But even if you do not consider Einstein's concept of the expansion of the universe, the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wills the creation to continue in itself is an act of creation. Because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu would cease to will the creation, then we would all revert back to tohu vavohu in a split second. It would just evaporate. I remember seeing footage from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I mean, terrible, terrible footage. And they showed that as much as humanly possible to show on a film from a distance, that there were 100,000 people who disintegrated. It's not that they burnt and died. There was nothing left of them. Nobody could find any zecher that they were here. They totally disintegrated. And that's what would happen for the whole world if a Kadosh Baruch Hu would cease to will the continuity of the creation. So there's Briat Olam. So we're constantly crowning God. Chabad has a ceremony. On the night of the first night of Rosh Hashanah, they call it, I remember the Rebbe used to use the Yiddish phrase that they use, Karanatzia Nacht, the coronation night, Leil Hachtara in Hebrew, and they would crown God. And the Rebbe spoke about this often enough, what God needs a crown, Bemet, he needs a crown from us. So there is an idea of what it means to bring HaKadosh Baruch Hu into this world. What does that mean? HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided to create the world and leave himself out. He left space. Because when you think about it, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all over the place, Malocho La'aretz Kavodo, there's no room for the created world. So the Kabbalists introduced the idea of Tzimtzum, that God condensed, contracted himself, and allowed for a little chor, a little hole, to exist without his, capital H, existence. And that became the created world. But he gave a mandate to the creatures on this world to invite him back in. And that's what we do. That is called bringing Shechina, whenever God's presence is here. So that means there is Shechina. This is a very important word with regard to Shofar, the word Shechina. Shechina means God's resting place. And God's resting place, in an eternal sense now, is Yerushalayim. As after David HaMelech, you know, locates the place that the Torah says, Ela makom asher yifchar Hashem l'shaken shmo sham. So this is what Shechina is all about. And why that place? What was so important about that place? Because that's where Avraham Avinu did the Akedah. So that place is very, very, very important. I don't know if I told you, I may have told you the story, so stop me in the middle if because it's just one of my popular stories about one of my kids. But, you know, one of my kids is the one I talk about most probably most often, but it has nothing to do with his flying. When he was an officer in the army, in the Tzanchanim, the paratroop unit, so there, the army, they do a wonderful thing here. They take soldiers in their training period to various places in Israel so that they should understand why we're fighting. And they really explain to them, they explain to them the Bar Kokhba revolution, they explain to them the Churban, they explain to them what all the stations of history of Eretz Israel, that especially a fellow comes from Russia and Olech Hadash, you know, what is it? He may not have learned anything about it, may not have gotten too much in school about it. And the army tries to inspire the soldiers that they should really be motivated, that there's good reason why we're here. And in light of, you know, the world politics and so on. So he had his group of 20 Chayalim in his command, and they were touring the old city, Yerushalayim, about 2 days, two, 3 days before Rosh Hashanah. And he asked me if I'd come and give them a talk, a sicha. Yeah, fine, why not? Lovely, lovely idea. So I asked them, I said, just so I should have my own understanding of the level, how many are religious soldiers, how many are not religious? Just not because I had any problem with talking to non-religious. He told me 19 are not religious and one is religious. I said, that's wonderful. Here, Kadosh Baruch Hu is giving me 19 chayalim on the palm of the hand to, for 15 minutes, 20 minutes. You know, you got to do something with them. So I told my son, I said, seat them in near the old city where they overlook the Har HaBayit. I want to talk about Har HaBayit. Okay, so before he has them in a standing formation, he's giving them some type of instructions. He tells me to stand aside. He wants to talk to them first. Fine, okay. Then he seats them down. And I get, and he introduces me, my father, very nice. And I get up and I give my sicha. And I realize that this has to be something that, in all likelihood, many of them may not be going to shul on Rosh Hashanah to hear a shofar. But I want them to understand why they should give it 10, 15 minutes of their time on Rosh Hashanah to do it. So I remember something the Rav said about the Mizbeach. The Mizbeach in the altar in the where they brought the Korbanot. So you have different artifacts in the Mishkan or the Beit HaMikdash. One clearly, actually two clearly speak of Torah. One is the Aron Brit in the Kodesh Kodeshim, and one is the Menorah, also symbolizes Torah. And there are other things there. There's no question that when it comes to Torah, there are gradations. There's no equality here. The Vilna Goin was the Vilna Goin, and the wagon driver was the wagon driver. I say that deliberately, because there are a lot of stories about the Baal Agala, or in Hebrew, the Eglon, the wagon driver of the Vilna Goin. Apparently, there's a whole tradition, because in my book, I write that when I was driving the Rav, I felt like I was the Eglon, was the wagon driver of the Rav. And that was a big, big thing, to be the wagon driver of the Vilna Goin. No small matter. So the Rav always said that when it comes to Torah, there's a big difference. So we said it in Nitzavim, there was the Rashechem Shiftechem, and then there was the the wood choppers and the water drawers. And beside that, the Pshuteyam, in Hebrew we say Pshuteyam, the simple people, the commoners, and so on. So when it comes to Torah, there's differences, there are gradations. And no, beside that, everybody understands that. There are differences in intellectual potential, there's the difference in intellectual accomplishment, there are differences in interest and motivation. There's so many differences which differentiates human beings, so you cannot expect equality in terms of the net result. That everybody understands. It's interesting that when it comes to the Mizbeach, on Sukkot, we drape the Mizbeach with Aravot. Interesting, with Aravot. Why Aravot? We know that the Medrash tells us there were four types of Jews. The Etrog, Jew, the Etrog has fragrance and taste. So there's a Jew who is imbued with Torah and Maasim Tovim, good deeds. Then there was the Lulav, which is the date. The date has taste, but has no fragrance. So that's the Jew who has Torah knowledge, but is not really performing. He studies Torah because he's intellectually curious, and he may be very knowledgeable, but he does not observe. And there are such people. Then you have people who are Hadas Jews. They have fragrance, but no taste. Those are Jews who may be ignoramuses, except that they have a tradition of how to perform mitzvot and do good deeds. And there are plenty of people in that category. And then there's the Arava Jew. The Arava Jew is no scent, no smell, no scent, and no taste, no flavor. So that's the Jew who has neither Torah nor Maasim Tovim. Okay. And then the Mishnah, the Gemara says that you have to bind them all together. Lulav Tzarich Eged, because that's Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael is everybody together. Take it or leave it. That's Klal Yisrael. You have to hold them all together, bind them together. It's a message of Achdut. So if you would tell me that you're going to take one of the four species and decorate something in the Beit HaMikdash, why not go for the Etrog? The Etrog is the symbol of the ideal. It's got it all. It's got Torah and Masim Tovim. The Arava has neither. Why do that? Why decorate the Mizbeach with Arava? So Rav said that the Mizbeach symbolizes self-sacrifice. That's what it was all about. And when it comes to self-sacrifice, it has nothing to do with being an intellectual genius. It has nothing to do with how much Torah you study. It has nothing to do with how many mitzvahs you perform. It has to do with, at the right moment, you answer the call, Hineni, yes, I'm willing to do it. And an Israeli soldier who puts on a uniform makes that statement of Hineni, yes, I'm willing to sacrifice myself for Am Yisrael. It's a tremendous declaration. And that's why even the Arava Jew has a place around the Mizbeach. And I said to the guys, look, I don't know exactly what your level of performance is, more or less, but even the Arava type of Jew has a part in this Beit HaMikdash. Right there, take a peek. You're looking at it right over there. I'm pointing to where the Mizbeach was. And I said, you know why it's there? Because Avram Avinu answered the call, Hineni, right there, right there. Take 10 minutes out of your day of Rosh Hashanah and go to shul and listen to the horn of the aisle of the ram that was Bimkom Yitzchak, was substituted for Yitzchak. And they're sitting and they're listening really, really intently. And I put it over well. It was good. It was good sicha and everything. Fine, you know, it's over and they're ready to roll. And I asked my son, I said, by the way, Eitan, what did you tell them before I started speaking? He says, I told them if anybody opens up their fat mouth when my father talks, they're not going home for Rosh Hashanah. I said, I thought they were listening because it was a good No, it was good. It was good. My son's just a clown. So it was very, very good. So this is crowning God, crowning God. Yes, we're bringing a Kadosh Baruch Hu into this world. And then you have the Inyan HaSheni. Inyan HaSheni, Ki Yom Rosh Hashanah, Hu Yom Rishon Aseret Yemei Teshuvah. It's true. It's the first of the series of 10 days before you get to Yom Kippur. V'tokim bo b'shofar, l'hachriz al Rashenu, kimoi kimi shemazhir v'omer, kol ha-rotzeh l'shuv yashuv. Which means it's an announcement call. Now begins the 10 days of tshuva, and the 10 days of tshuva is a process. So there's a signal, a public signal. Let's get going. Let's get started now with the Aseret Yemei Tshuva. So that's the second idea. And then comes the third, V'nyan HaShlishi. Laskirenu Ma'amad Har Sinai Shenemar Bo V'kol Shofar Chazak Ma'od. Now this we have in the Machzor, in Musaf. When we say the bracha of Shofarot, Ata nigleta ba'anan kvodecha, that third of the special brachot, we highlight Ma'amad Har Sinai, the giving of the Torah that was done with Kol Shofar Chazak Ma'od. So there is a rededication to Ma'amad Har Sinai. And to be fair, it's Rosh Hashanah hyphenated Yom Kippur here, because Yom Kippur is actually the second part of Shavuos. Chag HaShavuot is Man Matan Torateinu. But what do we get at Chag HaShavuot? So we got the beginnings. We got the beginnings. Moshe Rabbeinu goes up to Har Sinai 40 days, and he's going to come down and teach them all of the Torah. They only have the Aseret HaDibrot at when Moshe Rabbeinu goes up on Chag HaShavuot, at best. But when did they ultimately receive the Torah? In Yom Kippur. So the Rav's great-grandfather, who he was named after, Rav Yosef Dov Ber Soloveitchik, the Rosh Yeshiva of Elozhin, later to become Rav of Brisk, he was known as the Beis Halevi. So he said that Shavuos is the Matan Torah of the written law, Torah Shebichtav. But Yom Kippur became the Matan Torah for the oral law. And that answers a very, very, very peculiar question. We know that on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol had to do his service with absolute precision. There's only one catch. If he would do it exactly the way it's written in the Chumash, he would not fulfill his obligation. That was the fight with the Sadducean sect, with the Tzdukim, because they were doing it exactly the way it says in the Chumash. Our Chachamim came up with an interesting idea that there had to be 5 times that the Kohen Gadol goes to the mikveh and 10 times that he's going to wash his hands, Kiddush Adayim V'Raglayim, before and after a clothing change, because he wears his weekday 8-garment uniform for standard works activity on Yom Kippur, and he wears the white for unique Yom Kippur activity on Yom Kippur. And because the day oscillates between standard and Yom Kippur, so he's constantly changing. And the question is, how many times would he have to change? So according to the Chumash, he would have to change 6 times and go to the mikveh 3 times. But Chachamim said, no, he has to change 10 times and go to the mikveh 5 times. And in order to allow that to happen, we had to create an artificial entry into the Kodesh Kodashim that's going to obligate him to change and change back again, and therefore increase the mikveh from 3 to 5 and increase to get it to 10. So what did they do? At one point, there was the fire pan of the Ktoret that could have easily enough been taken out when the Kohen Gadol finishes that activity. But he leaves it there, and he goes out of the Kodesh Kodeshim, switches his clothing, does another activity, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the Musaf of the day, and then he has to change again to go back into the Kodesh Kodeshim, for one thing, to take out the pan, to take out the fire pan of the Ktoret. And that was done to trip up those who don't believe in the tradition, to show that Yom Kippur is based on the oral law. Torah Shebaal Peh. Yeah, Faksha. You use a potholder, no? Okay, good. Nobody ever thought of that. It's like in Shir once, the Rebbe was explaining how the Kohen Gadol in the Kodesh Kodashim had to take the dam, the blood of, there was a mixture of 2 of the animals, and sprinkle it on the curtain between the Kodesh Kodashim, but it wasn't supposed to touch the curtain. It was supposed to go towards the curtain and then drop. And the Rebbe said, I can't figure out how exactly to do that. And one guy in the Shir yells out, Rebbe, he throws a sinker pitch. If you know anything about baseball, so the pitch goes like this, and at the last second it dips. He said, I don't think the Rav knew what a sinker pitch was. It wasn't a baseball fan. I write in the book the one occasion that there was some interest. He had interest only because he was able to talk to his grandchildren about the game, about the Boston Red Sox, but that's something else. We're not going to discuss it now. Yeah. So that was the third Matan Torah, and then there's the fourth. Ve'anyan arvi laskirenu divrei hanevi'im shenimshelu ketkiat shofar. There's a reference in Sefer Yecheskel that the word of God is referred to allegorically as a blowing of the shofar. So as if the Navi talks, it's like the sound of a shofar. The sound of a shofar. There's even a saying. You know, sometimes you invite somebody to speak, but he's supposed to speak just for a few minutes, but he doesn't know that. And he keeps going on and on and on and on. So the phrase in Yiddish, I actually heard this once from Rabbi Macy Gordon's Olav Shalom. He said, Wenn man hält die Schäfer, blues man. When you're holding the Schäfer, you blow. You give somebody a microphone, he talks, right? So the Schäfer is a vehicle, you know, we even use it in modern Hebrew. If somebody is the spokesman for somebody, he's his shofar. It's used in modern Hebrew as a idiomatic expression. He's his shofar. So, and this is borrowed from Yechezkel. The Navi was the shofar of Am Yisrael, getting the news out. So because the Nevi'im spoke to us, reminding us about tshuva, so here's another reason for the shofar, to remind us about the prophets. And in Yana Chamishi, Laskirenu Chorban Beit HaMikdash, the Kol Truat Milchemet HaOyvim, to remind us of the destruction and the sounds of the warriors of the enemies at the time of the destruction. So this is where I mentioned, does Rav Sadia Gaon really believe that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he came down from Sinai and explains the Mishnah, the mitzvah of Shofar, does he incorporate this too? That there's going to be a Churban, there'll be a destruction, and this is one of the reasons? Or it didn't really mean that from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, these are all the reasons. These are now add-on reasons, obviously. Okay. The next one, the Shishi, is Laskirenu Akedat Yitzchak, Shemasar Nafsho Lo Shamayim, the Akedah. Now here, with regard to the Akedah, let me point out that the Akedah was never viewed as a historic moment only, but rather there's a continuum to the Akedah story. It didn't just come to an end. But what Avraham Avinu does with Yitzchak, or perhaps better yet, what Yitzchak allows Avraham to do. Remember, we call it Akedat Yitzchak. We don't call it Akedat Avraham. Yitzchak had to go along with it. According to Rashi, he was 37 years old. So, okay, Ebenezer thinks he was maybe 14 years old. But nevertheless, you're not talking about a baby. You're talking about somebody who could have run away from this whole thing and is willing to go along with all this. The Ibn Ezra brings a perush in Parshat Vayera that he anonymous commentary, and he rejects it out of hand as pshat, but nevertheless finds it welcoming enough to quote it. And what's the commentary? There's a textual question at the end of the story, a postscript. Vayashav Avraham el Ne'arav. Avraham returns to the lads, to the young ones who he left off before the story starts. Where's Yitzchak? Where's Yitzchak? How come he doesn't come back? So the Medrash talks about it, you know, all kinds of things. Where's Yitzchak? So this Parshan says, Yitzchak was slaughtered. He was slaughtered on the Akedah. One sec, I can't say that. Keep pushing, turning the pages of the Chumash. In Parshat Chayei Sarah, he's there. In Parshat Toldot, he's there. In Vayishlach, he's still there. He dies in Vayishlach. So what do you mean he was slaughtered? Ah, he was slaughtered, but there was a Triat HaMetim. He was resurrected. Now, there's a part, so Ebenezer says, no, that's not the pshat, no, forget it. Who in the world ever said it? And why was it said? And why did the Ebenezer think it was worthwhile for us to even know that perush? If not for the fact that some community rabbi, in the aftermath of the first crusades, when he saw half his community go up on the Akedah and not come down, and tried to console them, the Yitzchak also didn't come down, but he came up again. And so too they will rise one day. It was a message of consolation after a tzara. And in that context, so it's not the pshat, but in that context, there's validity. There's something very valid in that kind of a story. The Rav always talks about the fact that Judaism is a sacrificial religion. It demands sacrifice, but not necessarily the ultimate, but sometimes the ultimate sacrifice. But there are other sacrifices that are sometimes painful to a person. Sometimes it's financial. Sometimes it's the decision where to live. I'd love to live in this neighborhood. It's just, I can't bring up my kids in that neighborhood. So I'm going to live in a different neighborhood that I'm not comfortable with, I'm not happy with, but the environment might be better. I'd love to eat that food. It looks so delicious. I'm MasterChef in, you know, in America, they talk wonders. It's strafe, you know, can't do it. They're things that people pull back. They pull back, and it's an act of sacrifice. Every single step we take, there can potentially be an act of sacrifice. My brother in Teaneck would always say that the most successful form of contraception in America is yeshiva tuition. Yeshiva tuition. that can't afford another child. That's all. You know, today's rates. I mean, I'm out of touch already, but I understand that. Don't even ask, right? Don't even ask. It's just out of sync. So, you know, how many people make 200? That's why people come on Aliyah today, by the way. It's like an unbelievable flip-flop. Yeah. There's a tremendous flip-flop, and beside that, there is sacrifice. So on Yom Kippur, when we say the bracha of Zichron, I'm sorry, on Rosh Hashanah, we say the bracha of Zichronot, Ata Zocher Maasei Olam. So there, Kadosh Baruch Hu, you know, rolls out the memory card, but not only the memory card of yesterday, but to Kadosh Baruch Hu, there's a memory card of tomorrow. So Fe'u Mabit Atzof Kol Hadorot. Kadosh Baruch Hu is checking out everybody. And sometimes we have very little merit for ourselves, but if a Kadosh Baruch Hu checked 10 generations down the road, he would see that it's worth keeping us around for what's going to happen in 10 generations. On Tuesday, on the first day of Rosh Hashanah, in Musaf of Rosh Hashanah, at the beginning of the Chazarat Hashatz, there's a piyut. I'll read it. I brought a machzor, actually. There's a poem that is said. It says, Upat me'az l'shevet hayom b'chon ma'aseh yom. Kadosh Baruch Hu is like with his robes on, ready to sit in justice. And then he goes on and looks at Adam HaRishon. He was given one mitzvah, not to eat from the Eitz Hadaat. And he blew it. He ate from the Eitz Hadaat. But what does the Torah say about if you're going to eat from the Eitz Hadaat? Ki b'yom achocha mimenu motamut. The day you eat from it, you're going to die. So basically, it was a death sentence by eating from the Eitz Hadaat. But we know that Adam lives 930 years. That's not bad. 930 years. Why? So the Paitan says, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu took a glance 10 generations, 20 generations down the road, and he saw Avram Avinu. And because there's going to be an Avram Avinu, it's worth keeping Adam around, even though he doesn't deserve it. And to a certain degree, we tell HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I know he's sofer umabit at sof kol adorot. At the end of days, they're going to be people still around appreciating Vaya Hashem Lemelech HaKol HaAretz. And if we're not here to continue living, you're not going to have that tzibur, that community, at the end of days. And it works. And furthermore, Va'akedat Yitzchak Lizaro Hayom Barachamim Tizkor. Before we end the bracha, Baruch Atah Hashem Koret HaBrit of the Zichronot, we say, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu should remember the Akedat Yitzchak today. So normally, how is it interpreted? Today on Rosh Hashanah, Kadosh Baruch Hu should remember the Akedah of old. The Rav said, no. It's the contemporary Akedah. Va'akedat Yitzchak Lizaro Hayom Berachamim Tizkor. The Kadosh Baruch Hu should check out our Akedah on whatever level it might be. Whatever we are doing as a self-sacrifice to be close to Kadosh Baruch Hu, he should take it into consideration. And I'm willing to say, hineni. And I've said in the shul a few years ago that the chazan who begins musaf, hineni he'ani mimas, hineni he'ani mimas, is nothing but a public proclamation for everyone, hineni. We're ready, right? It's almost like Leonard Cohen's. He ends with it's a hineni, so for sure. All right, so now we have that was the sixth, and the seventh is kishenishma et kiat shofar nira v'nechad. It'll instill fear, literally. It'll shake you up. It'll jolt you into action. Okay, so it has that impact as well. The eighth, Inyan HaShmini, it will remind you of Yom Adin, that there is day of accounting and judgment, that the court is in session, and you should take note of it. The ninth is the great announcement of Kibbutz Goliot. You remember the pasuk, Vaya Bayamahu? We say it in Shofarot. Yitaka b'shofar gadol, uva'ovdim be'eretz Ashur, v'anidachim be'eretz Mitzrayim, V'shtachavu l'Hashem b'har ha-kodesh Yerushalayim. So it's a shofar gadol. Why is it a shofar gadol? Because it's going to be a tkiya gadola, right? And you need a shofar gadol to get out a tkiya gadola. So Rav Kook spoke about this in 1934, the year before he dies, in the old city, in the Ramban Shul. And he says the following. I think it was the Churva Shul, which was related to. It was in the Churva Shul. He says the following. There are three different grades of shofar that are kosher. The best, the acceptable, and I wish I wouldn't have to. So the best is the shofar of a ram. That's the best. And because that's going to remind you of the Akedah, the ram in the Akedah story. That's the preferred option, without a doubt. But then the Mishnah tells us, kol ha-shofarot k'sherot, all shofarot of kosher animals, even if it's not a ram, are also adequate. And then the third level, mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, is what happens if you have you don't have a kosher shofar. You don't have a kosher shofar, neither from a ram nor from a kosher animal. But you have a shofar from an idol worshiper. An idol worshiper. You're not going to use a shofar from an idol worshiper. But if this is all you have, so it says that you should use it. The Mishnah Berurah, Chofetz Chaim says, don't make a bracha, just blow the shofar. And if you're lucky enough during the day, during the course of the day, to get a real shofar, blow again. Blow again. But the bottom line was, use the shofar that's disqualified. Which means in a situation that's there's no other recourse, you can even use a shofar that's disqualified. So that's obviously the, I wish I did wouldn't have to, type of brand. Then Rav Kook goes on and he says, the shofar gadol announces the coming back to Eretz Yisrael. Vav of the Eretz Yisrael. There are three different sounds. There's the sound of Harakodesh Yerushalayim. Why are you coming back to Eretz Yisrael? Because there's a holy mountain and there's Yerushalayim and there's Beit HaMikdash. This is why we're coming back. For genuine spiritual religious reasons. But then there are those who are going to come back to Eretz Yisrael not because of spirituality or religiosity, but because of nationalism, Zionism. This is Rav Kook in 1934. And he says, it's kosher. It's a kosher concept, nationalism. If you come back to the land of Israel because of purely nationalistic reasons, it's not a demerit. It's positive. It may not be the ideal, but it's something, you know, certainly worthwhile. Kol ha-shofarot k'sherim. You can use all kosher shofarot. But then there are some people who are going to come to Israel not because of spirituality and not even because of deeply rooted nationalism. But why? Because the Gentile is going to hate them so and going to kick them out. That's the third level of taking the shofar from the goy, from the behemat me'ah, from the non-kosher animal. So if you have no other recourse, you can use it on Rosh Hashanah. Rav Kook says, these are the people who are going to come because of Ein Breira, no choice, no other choice. So he says, and we ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu on Rosh Hashanah that our return should be from the Shofar Gadol. The Shofar Gadol is grade A, is the choice Shofar. Of Vaya Bayomahu Yitaka B'Shofar Gadol, Uvau Odin Beretz Ashur, Vanidachim Beretz Yisrael. And Rav Kook, in this discussion, mentions in the context of the wish I wouldn't have to use this shofar level, he mentions Hitler. Hitler came to power in 1933. The drasha was given a year later. Rav Kook dies a year afterwards in 35. And he's already anticipating what this is all about. Anticipating. And he says, and he's begging. You know, Rav Kook went there to the Aguda Convention of Rabbonim in 1912, before the outbreak of the World War I. Begged the Rabbanim to consider mass aliyah to Eretz Yisrael. And he was literally laughed off the stage. Laughed off the stage. That's when he was stuck in World War I. World War I. You know, it wasn't like today, make a speech and get on a plane and come home. You know, it was not so easy. He was stuck there for a few years because of the war. But unfortunately, he saw it and others didn't. And then the last one is, Inyan ha'asiri, laskirenu tchiyat amitim. The Triat HaMitim it's very difficult to talk about it because we don't know much about it. We know there's a bracha, the second bracha in every Shmoneh Esrei, v'ne'eman atah l'achiyot metim. Right? It's Judaism's answer to mortality. You know, because everyone fears dying, but this has been so inculcated into the hearts and minds of Jews of the period of Triyat HaMetim that it eases the pain somewhat of death. As Rabbi Maurice Lamb, Zecharon Livracha, writes in his book on mourning, death is the night that lies between two great days. And if you see it in that context, it's less troubling and less painful. The Rambam himself had great difficulty articulating the case for Triyat HaMetim to the extent that it's hardly mentioned in his Mishneh Torah. It talks about Yemot HaMashiach, but not about Triyat HaMetim. That it was suggested he actually didn't believe it. So he writes a letter, Igeret Ma'amar Triyat HaMetim, just to put it on record, yeah, I believe it. And even in the 13 principles, so the last one we say, Meitim Yichaya El Barov Chazdo, we sing it in Yigdal, Baruch Adayat Shem Tzidato. So in the Perush HaMishnah, where he expands on each of the 13, when he gets to the 13th, it's one line. Vayikara, the 13th is Triyat HaMetim. No, not a word of explanation. And it almost, and in Mishnah Torah, nothing, doesn't talk about it. So it suggested that the Rambam put it on the sidelines. But because he was accused of not believing in it, and he could not say, I don't believe in it, because he lists those who deny Triyat HaMetim as one of the 24 who tshuva doesn't work, if you're in that category of a heretic. So you have to believe in it. But the Rambam says, you believe in it in the most general terms, without going into any specifics, because we really don't know how this is going to work. One thing is that I always talk about Triyat HaMetim when I stand in Poland in Majdanek under the rotunda of 8 tons of human ash that was taken out of the from the crematoriums and dumped into a pit. So the Poles made actually a very respectable rotunda on top of it to be protected from the elements. You can still see bone fragments there, and you can see it. I always tell the Kohanim, there you can't walk. That's for sure not. That's 100% an oil. But I also say that I have no problems how a Kadosh Baruch Hu will pull off Triyat HaMetim from what's left here. Because if a Kadosh Baruch Hu can pull off Triyat HaMetim from anything, what's the difference? You think anything's left? Maybe a skull, maybe a spine, and that's it? But nothing's left from the organism. Things are going to have to somehow regenerate. So it'll regenerate. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do it. What's the only necessary prerequisite for Triyat HaMetim is the belief in it. So if a person says, oh, this is really silly. Okay, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, silly. So it's not for you. So don't ever say that it's silly. You know, play it right. Well, it's not a wise investment, right? To think that it's silly. Not silly. Kadosh Baruch Hu promises that through the Nevi'im, it's not in the Chumash, by the way. There are references in the Chumash. For example, it says, Az Yashir Moshe. Moshe will sing in the plural. The Gemara says, okay. The Gemara says that you will give Truma to Aaron HaKohen. And everybody says, one second, Aaron HaKohen dies in the Midbar, in the desert. There is no giving of Truma until they enter into Eretz Yisrael. So if it would say to Bnei Aaron, I would understand. You have to give to the Kohanim the Truma. But what does it mean, give Truma to Aaron? So the Gemara says, hey, you see, it's Triyat HaMetim. One day he's going to be around. And you'll be able to give it to him. And there's a whole slew of expressions in the Gemara, Mikan Triyat HaMetim HaTorah. May you see it as an allusion to Triyat HaMetim in the Chumash itself. So like Rambam says about Mashiach, you know, patience. But the difference between the Rambam and the Ramban on this is the Ramban believes that Triyat HaMetim goes together with Mashiach times. And the Rambam says no. Mashiach time is one thing and people are going to die. It may not be as tragic as it is today, but people will still die. And Triyat HaMetim is something way beyond the era of Yemot HaMashiach. And I remember I had this out once with a Lubavitcher. And I said, I also felt when the Lubavitcher Rebbe was alive, I had no better candidate for Mashiach. I couldn't think of anybody better than the Lubavitcher Rebbe, my humble opinion. But he died. And when he died, that's it. Like the Rambam said about Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba was killed. And that was it. It was over, you know. They thought he was Mashiach. Rabbi Kiva thought he was Mashiach, but he wasn't. And that's it. So he's not going to be Mashiach. So a friend of mine, a Chabadnik, says, yeah, but there'll be Triyat HaMetim, you know, so he'll still be Mashiach, according to the Ramban. It'll be a time of Mashiach time, Triyat HaMetim. So I said, if it's already going to be Triyat HaMetim, why should it be Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson? It'll be already David HaMelech, right? So it'll be David HaMelech. So the fellow told me that the neshama of the Rebbe is a incarnated, a Gilgul of the neshama of David HaMelech. Okay, if we're up to Gilgul, I stop the conversation. There's a Radak in Sefer Yecheskel where it says, "B'David Avdi Melech Alehem." David, my servant, will be ruling. And it's a messianic parak. So first he says, it doesn't mean David. It means somebody from the genealogy of David. B'nei David. As it says in Yeshua. And then he brings a second opinion. No, could be that Yemad HaMashiach will be Triyat HaMetim, and it's going to be Mr. David HaMelech himself. So in this one breath, the Radak brings both views. First it brings the Rambam's view, then it brings the Ramban's view. So we'll sit back and relax. But it's the 10th idea of Rav Sadia Gaon of why we sound the shofar, because the world is going to explode in sound when this happens. It's going to be a whole load of blowings when this Triyat HaMetim. So we have a lot of things to think about when we blow shofar. And when we sound out the Truot, whatever versions they are, we should have in mind our personal saga and situation. Each and every one of us have different things on our agendas, personal, family-wise, collective-wise. We should think about them and ask Kadosh Baruch Hu to be overly compassionate with us, give us a year of health, and do away with a pandemic, you know. And he's giving us what's called the kelim, the to help ourselves do away with the pandemic. So we should give some seichel to those people who think that they can do it without what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is teaching us to do. And God willing, it'll be a good year and a healthy year and a peaceful year. And okay, we'll see you in Tavshin Pei Bet, B'Shah Tov and Mitzlachat, in 2 weeks. Okay.